difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts in a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Tasha Robinson,
Keith Phipps,
and Genevieve Koski.
Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we're in the trenches of World War I. The Germans are picking off cinephiles one by one, and if we want to bring an end to the war, we're going to have to try something audacious. Genevieve, what are our options?
Option A, we can storm a German anthill. If we succeed, which we almost certainly won't, we'll lose more than half our men trying, but a French general will get a big promotion. If we fail, three of our men will be singled out arbitrarily for cowardice and shot by a firing squad to boost troop morale.
Whew. I gotta say, Genevieve, option A sounds awful. What's option B?
Option B is that we recruit an Amazon warrior and demigoddess who was sculpted from clay and given life by the gods. Then, we force the Germans to surrender by destroying their chemical weapons cache and setting our demigoddess against Ares, the god of war, in a battle royale.
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better about option B, but this week, on the Next Picture Show, we're going to fully explore our options. On today's episode, we'll look at Paths of Glory, Stanley Kubrick's anti-war classic about French troops forced into a suicide mission by their superiors. Then later in the week, we'll bring in Wonder Woman, which sends Princess Diana into the same conflict against the Germans of World War I and discovers the best and worst of humanity in the process. We'll dive into the aesthetic trenches after the break.
Hello there, soldier. Ready to kill more Germans?
Yes, sir.
What's your name, soldier?
Sir, Private for all Company A.
Uh-huh. You married, Private?
No, sir.
Well, I'll bet your mother's proud of you.
Yes, sir.
Well, carry on, Private, and good luck to you.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Morning, General.
Good morning. Hello there, soldier.
Sir.
Ready to kill more Germans?
Yes, sir.
Ha-ha. Working over your rifle, I see. Well, that's the way. It's a soldier's best friend. You be good to it, and it'll always be good to you.
Yes, sir.
Well, good luck to you, soldier. Carry on.
Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory was based on a novel by Humphrey Cobb, which itself was inspired by a New York Times story about five French soldiers who were executed by firing squad during World War I. I haven't read the novel, but according to James Naremore's essay on the Criterion edition of the film, Cobb, quote, provided a harrowing account of trench warfare and an appalling picture of how generals treated their troops as cannon fodder. Both of those elements are evident in Kubrick's film, which conveys better than any film I've ever seen the yard-by-yard difficulty of advancing from one position to another under barricades and intense enemy fire. But the specifics of Paths of Glory serve as political sentiments that could carry over into any war, and would, to some extent, with the Cold War theatrics of Kubrick's satire Dr. Strangelove and his Vietnam film Full Metal Jacket. The dehumanization of man would be a primary theme of Kubrick's career, as would the abuses of power that go along with it. What's bold about Paths of Glory is that the ultimate justice of turning back Germany in World War I is rendered absolutely meaningless, to the point where it scandalized Europe with its alleged anti-military bent. The film was held from French release until the mid-70s, it was pulled from the Berlin Film Festival, and it was kept out of Francisco Franco's Spain until 11 years after his death. The title, Paths of Glory, in Kubrick's rendering, is to be read with the deepest sarcasm. To me, it's as savage a satire on the arrogance and buffoonery of military leadership as Dr. Strangelove, even though moments of it are filled with righteous passion and heartbreaking pathos. The situation is absurd and tragic in equal measure, and the miracle of the film is that the two elements coalesce. In that first conversation between General Georges Brulard and his subordinate, General Moreau, in a decadent space far from the trenches, we can recognize the absurdity of Moreau agreeing to push a suicidal attack on a German anthill for the benefit of a promotion and an extra star. And we can see it again later when the mission fails and three good men are selected arbitrarily for court-martial just so the same officer class can save face. But on the ground level, Paths of Glory taps into the fury of Kirk Douglas's Colonel Dax, who does everything he can to argue against the mission and argue in favor of his men in kangaroo court, but to no avail in either case. Kubrick has been labeled a cold technician in some circles, but there are scenes in Paths of Glory of blistering fury and devastating tragedy as the pleas of Dax and the accused come up short. The film is about how the war machine operates, about the consequential decisions that are made at the top of the chain and the ground troops at the bottom who have to pay for them. In that, it makes a universal statement about war and the deplorable ways in which it is waged.
Hello there, soldier. Ready to kill more Germans? That is everything all right, soldier?
All right. Yes, sir, I'm all right.
Good fella. Are you married, soldier?
Married? Me married?
Yes, have you got a wife?
A wife? Have I got a wife?
He's a bit shell-shocked.
I beg your pardon, Sergeant. There is no such thing as shell-shock. Have you got a wife, soldier?
My wife? My wife. Yes, I have a wife. I'm never going to see her again. I'm going to be killed.
Get a grip on yourself. You're acting like a coward.
I am a coward, sir.
Snap out of it, soldier! Sergeant, I want you to arrange for the immediate transfer of this baby out of my regiment. I won't have other brave men contaminated by him. Yes, sir.
So, Paths of Glory is probably my favorite Stanley Kubrick movie. So, I hope everyone else liked it. So, I'm going to now ask you, with that preface, did you like the film
No
Paths
pressure.
Of Glory?
I really liked it. And I admit, I wasn't expecting to not like it, but I wasn't expecting to like it as much as I did, just because, as I think I've established on here before, war movies are generally not my bag. But, boy, this was a really engaging and kind of infuriating watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, infuriating is the right word for it. It's so emotionally effective. It's mm-hmm. so moving. It's so well crafted in that cold classic Kubrick way, to as like a machine to make you feel what he wants you to feel. But it's so effective. And I mean, that's always just what I come out of it with. Like, it's impossible, I think, to watch this film and not be moved in a bunch of different directions. I think he just does such an amazing job of setting up, with very small movements, the humanity of the soldiers and the situations under which you're going to feel empathy for them, and then the callousness and heartlessness of the people above them. And then suddenly it becomes even more personal than that, as, you know, the general becomes just more and more insulting and infuriating. Mm-hmm. It's just, he leads you on this little path of glory. He leads you on this little path of emotion throughout the film. And it's just, it's really pretty masterful.
Yeah, that's just it. I've never bought the Stanley Kubrick as solely as cold technician argument at all. I mean, I find his approach can be a little distanced, but I don't think what he's showing you within the frame in any given film. And I find a lot of his films very moving, to be devoid of emotion. This is an incredibly moving film in several different moments and in several different ways. And it's definitely, it's not my favorite Kubrick, but it's quite an accomplished movie, and I love it a lot.
One of the reasons why it's my favorite, beyond just being tight too, it's 90 minutes and it just,
Not even, right.
It's a very tight movie. But what I find interesting is how I do think it's often as bitterly funny and absurdist as Dr. Strangelove. But not in any way that diminishes or takes away from the tragedy of the story, the emotional aspects of the story. Like, both of those things are able to coexist and not feel, you know, like two different movies happening at the same time.
No, and I think also it is affecting in a way that Strangelove can't be, because you have a human face. You have these people who are going to be killed, mm-hmm. and they don't have to be killed. It's a decision being made by the superiors for reasons that we see as completely heartless. And it's a lot easier to relate to that than the death of the entire planet in many ways.
Yeah, it's sort of the fate of the world in Dr. Strangelove, but because of Dr. Strangelove's comedic elements, which are very broad and very over the top in some places, it feels, the stakes don't feel as big as they do here when they're small and personal and specific.
Yeah, well, and each of those men that are on trial have their own character, and they have their own reason that they are been selected and put on trial. And, like, you know, you mentioned how efficient this movie is and how short it is, and just being able to get across three distinct secondary characters, really, that are really what the emotional element of it turns on, I think is pretty extraordinary.
And consider one of those cases, and this is what I'm talking about as far as the absurdity and the tragedy of it being linked, is that in one of those cases, a guy was knocked unconscious, you know, by the trench. I mean, that was it. That was the end of the day for him, because he was unconscious, and he's one of the guys who's being selected for this court martial. And it, on its face, it is it's so ridiculous, and it's also completely infuriating and unjust. And
well, that cut on his head could have been self inflicted.
Yeah, sure, of course, whatever they want to make up. And of course, when they're in front of that court martial, and the conclusion that is already been made as far as the fate of these men, you just have Kirk Douglas's character, Dax, just bumping up against ridiculous bits of logic that he cannot overcome, because that is the conclusion they're coming to. As you said, that could have been self-inflicted. I mean, it's just, he's never going to win. And it's just, you feel so upset by that. But, you know, for me, in a lot of these cases, I find myself laughing a little bit, too, about how ridiculous it is.
I think one of the neatest little efficiencies of the film is that Kubrick does not even bother to show you the judges deliberating or handing down their sentence. We cut directly from the end of the trial to a sergeant informing his men of how the execution is going to work. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, watching that trial scene, it seemed inevitable how it was going to go. But because it's a movie, you know, and because it's a war movie of its era, you hope, you know, you have a hope that they will listen to Kirk Douglas's anguished and emotional and in some ways logical and like legally sound plea for them to consider the enormity of what they're doing. And then he skips past all of it. It's just like they were in no way affected by that, because that's the story being told, is it's about the inhumanity of the military system. But the fact that we don't waste any time on watching, on repeating what we already know about those men, about the judges, about the system, and we just cut straight from one thing to the other, it always amazes me. And it kind of takes the rug out from under you, too, because you think that you're going to get more of this logic of what it is that is so important to men other than our principles about, like, why it's important that we murder these innocent men. And instead, it's just like there's just sort of a shrug of, we already know we're doing everything inefficiently and unjustly, and that is not in any way entering into our thinking.
I think also it says something about Kirk Douglas's taste to sign on for this film, in which he plays a brilliant lawyer who is completely ineffective, and not through any fault of his own. It's just things are so stacked against him. He loses at every turn. And he doesn't come off as a weak character or someone who you would say is not a brilliant lawyer or a skilled mind or a great soldier. At the same time, he gets nowhere.
Yeah, his performance here reminds me so much of his performance in Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, which is another performance. It maybe has less of a tinge of acid to it, but it's another kind of egoless performance from a man who is not afraid to play a character who is in no way heroic and in no way successful. Like, he doesn't have to be the cleft-chinned, two-fisted hero in his movies. He seems to be just much more interested in these, like, acerbic statements.
It's egoless except for the fact that a shirtless scene was written into his contract. They had to do a shirtless scene in Paths of Glory.
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit. I think his actions are entirely heroic.
In this movie.
They're heroic in this movie.
They're not successful all the time, but he's actually...
Keith's point was specifically that he doesn't have to be the winner.
Oh, sure.
And I'm
saying
in Ace in the Hole, he doesn't have to be – he's also not the winner there, but he's also not the hero. The point is just he doesn't have to be this, the covered in glory hero in his movies.
Sure.
He doesn't have to save the day. He doesn't have to save the day. Like, he is more interested in these, like, really interesting films, these really interesting stories, than in playing what was, you know, a kind of a cliched idea of a movie star at the time.
I mean, and his patronage is a big reason why Kubrick was able to have the career that he had. Paths of Glory would not have gotten made certainly with Stanley Kubrick as director, were it not for Kirk Douglas's advocacy, and then of course Spartacus after that, which is a film that Kubrick has distanced himself from to an extent. But Douglas is certainly a key player in helping one of the truly great American filmmakers have a career.
And I think just his sarcasm in this film is what gives it any sense of humor. It's a bitter sense of humor, but like he's funny. He's funny in a very painful way here. But his performance is so important because it neatly straddles the line between going along with the things he's been ordered to do enough to prove that he is a soldier. You know, he is a brave man. He is trying to do what he has been told is the right thing to do. You know, he's not a slacker. He's not a layabout. He's not that shell-shocked guy at the beginning of the film. He's honestly trying. But at the same time, he knows the absurdity of what he's being asked to do. He hates it. And he doesn't cower before all of these people who are telling him to do the wrong thing. It's just a great performance.
But he also is a soldier, and he does follow orders, and that's like especially evident at the beginning where he is given this impossible task. He knows it's an impossible task, and he does push back against it to honestly about the same extent that Moreau does in that opening scene. But once it's clear that like this is the order, and you are gonna see the order through, like he does it. When it comes down to it, he is a soldier, and he watches his men be executed.
I think he respects what the military. I think he's an exemplar of military leadership that the film needs because further up the chain, the motives for, you know, turning these men into cannon fodder are just deplorable. So, you know, here you have someone who is always at every step of the way looking out for his men, both on the battlefield and then also in court and then also as they're preparing to die. And, of course, pointedly, he is out there blowing his whistle and he's on the front lines.
He's the first one out of the trench.
He's out of the trench. And I mean,
Not unlike Wonder Woman.
And if you, exactly. Right. See, this pairing is a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a difference. So he's out there leading by example, and I'm sure it seems like until this moment, they've had a tremendous amount of success. Right? At least it's implied that they've had success in other missions, and they're a good unit, but this is an absurd thing they're not being asked to do.
It's also just a very carefully written role. I mean, one of the things rewatching it this time, I think I was most aware of, is that you can see how he got to where he is, and it's not just a matter of his bravery or his willingness to obey orders. It's a matter of knowing when he can push back and when he can't, and being willing to push back, but also respecting the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels unlikely in many ways that General Moreau got to where he is. It does not feel unlikely that Colonel Dax has made it as far in the military as he has, and you can see how he could go farther.
Patriotism may be old-fashioned, but show me a patriot and I'll show you an honest man.
Well, not everyone has always thought so. Samuel Johnson had something else to say about patriots.
And what was that, may I ask?
Well, nothing really.
What do you mean, nothing really?
Well, sir, nothing really important.
Colonel, when I ask a question, it's always important. Now, who was this man?
Samuel Johnson,
sir. All right. Now, what did he have to say about patriotism?
He said it was the last refuge of a scoundrel, sir. I'm sorry. I meant nothing personal.
You're tired, Dax. You're very tired. It's you who are exhausted, not your men. And it's my fault. I've given you one impossible task after another. You need rest. You need it badly. And you never would either. Therefore, you're not going to have any say-so about it, Colonel. As from right now, I'm ordering you on indefinite furlough.
General, you can't take me away from my men. You can't do that to me, sir.
Not to you, Dax. For you. For your good and for the good of your men.
The good of my men, sir.
If a commanding officer lacks confidence, what can we expect of his men? Naturally, I don't want to relieve you, but I must have your enthusiastic support. Not once have you said that your men can take the anthill.
We'll take the anthill. If any soldiers in the world can take it. We'll take the anthill.
So with The Killing and Paths of Glory, Kubrick really started to come into his own stylistically. So I was curious, you know, how you would describe the style of Paths of Glory and how it serves the story.
Well, at the beginning of this conversation, when we were talking about kind of the reputation he has as a cold technician, the technical achievements in this film are in service of emotion. And that's what's kind of so extraordinary and admirable about it. And you mentioned it a little in the keynote, but the thing that stood out to me so much with the style of this movie is how the two sides of the military are framed and how the officers are in this palace, basically, and how they are framed within that palace where you see them surrounded by the opulence and they are almost dwarfed by it whenever they are in that setting, and compared to the trenches and just the claustrophobia of that setting. And it's really heightened by the way he uses light. Those trench sequences are so, so stark.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel the claustrophobia of being in there.
Yeah, and the officers are bathed in light in that place. Just the basic need to see the sunshine is something that's denied to these people, or at least, you know, they can't get their heads above and their holes in the ground to take in the atmosphere in any way. It's just such a really basic contrast in how these people live on a day-to-day basis. And I mean, I feel like the palatial setting is probably exaggerated from how the conditions actually were, but maybe not that much. And certainly, you know, you get to a deeper truth with that. Whereas the trenches, boy, I mean, I wouldn't want to find any war, guys. But I think if I had my choice of wars, World War I would be pretty low on the list. The trench warfare, the gas,
yeah.
Yeah, it seems like one of the worst ones.
That setting, that opulent setting. I mean, for one, one thing I admire about it stylistically is that he allows the sound to be echoey and rattle through the space, which is fine. I think that works just fine. But it really gets you thinking, and if even if it's, or especially if it's overblown, because those are really the most satirical scenes of the movie, the most absurd scenes of the movie. You really get to thinking about how decisions of enormous consequence are made, really enormous consequence are made, and where those settings are. Because, you know, when you're talking about dictating major movements in wars, dictating just going to war, those are not those are decisions that are made in the Oval Office or made in these palaces or in over tea and, you know, service. They're not made where Kirk Douglas is standing. You know, they're not made with a real sense of like what the actual human cost is going to be. It's much, you know, and you get that such a stark sense of that distance, of that disconnect between what they're casually talking about, which is a mission that's going to kill over half of these men, you know, probably not succeed. That's a much different calculation when you're on the ground and, you know, you're actually looking at the people who are going to lose their lives.
But I think that's one of the fascinating things about this film is General Moreau gets down into the trenches and meets these men. He looks them in the eyes. He
insults them.
He interviews them. He smacks one of them. He probably does not see them as people, given the fact that he asks all of them the same question. You know, there's just sort of a boilerplate to it. But he's not living in that palace far from the front lines with no idea of what these people are and no connection to their humanity. He's able to look them in the eyes, speak to them as people, and then walk into the colonel's sort of dugout and say, hey, here's the plan. Half of those people I just talked to are going to die. Like, there, yeah. it makes him
so much more evil that way, though.
Really, that's just it. Yeah. It makes him, it makes him even more of a sociopath than the people in Wonder Woman sitting like literally a country away from the front lines and determining what's going to happen. He sees it and it doesn't matter to him. Like, he sees the humanity of the people that are there, and yet he doesn't engage with it at all.
Well, in his approach to, we're getting away from talking about the style, but I want to continue on this thread because it's interesting. But like, his approach to any suffering or problem that a soldier may have is to dismiss them. You know,
shock doesn't exist.
Yeah,
it's not a thing.
Just get him out of here, dismiss him. And he does it later in the film, too. It might actually be with Dax. He tries to, like, dismiss Dax.
There's the whole business where Private Farrell goes off to his death, weeping hysterically and terrified. And afterwards, the general says, you know, oh, they were so brave. It couldn't have been better. What a glorious thing it was. You know, how beautiful it was. Like, he very clearly was there and yet didn't process any of that emotion.
Yeah.
It's like he's already writing the historical account of it.
Yes.
Just to kind of go back to style, too, for a second. I mean, for one, you get, you know, at least one spectacular Kubrick tracking shot in the trenches when you're yeah. The camera's right.
I don't even know how that was.
Cameras
done,
right in front of
you can see where the tracks would be.
Yeah, and it was pre Steadicam.
Yeah, and so, this is someone for whom Steadicam may as well have been invented, and you know, kind of doing that before there was such a thing.
Yeah,
I remember reading something.
I'm not really sure how it was accomplished technically.
I remember something involving the camera person and the set director arguing because they had to make the trenches bigger in order to fit the dollies, to fit the cameras in there. I don't know if they just...
I mean, you don't have to be on tracks. I guess you can push the dolly, but that terrain doesn't seem like it would give you a smooth shot.
That terrain is entirely created, though. Like, they literally took a field and spent 3 weeks just digging those trenches, so they had perfect
That's a Kubrick thing, too.
Oh, yeah, of course.
To do all of that. I mean,
literally
here's a guy. I mean, here's a guy who had lenses invented for Barry Lyndon so it could accommodate a film that was... you know, lit by candlelight. The guy is a good photographer, but boy, what a powerful way to shoot that scene.
Apparently the cameras were just on dollies. They dug the trenches extra wide to give the dollies more room to operate. But I mean, you can kind of see like sort of the image like rising and falling with the movement of the trenches. But I would love to see behind the scenes shots of how they accomplished it.
Also, the actual storming of the anthill, which can we just acknowledge that calling it the anthill is kind of brilliant? Like the fact that like this impossible mission is for something so small and insignificant, yet so populated.
Yeah, in the novel, it's called the Pimple. Which is maybe even more reductive.
Calling it the molehill probably would have been like too on the nose, but the, you know, the anthill's good. But anyway, in the sequence where serving the anthill, which is amazing on so many levels, but what I was struck by, especially after seeing Wonder Woman, which uses music very liberally to goose it, is that in Paths of Glory, during that battle scene, it's like you are just inundated with sound. There's no music, mm-hmm. but it's just explosions and gunfire, and it is oppressive, and it is like it's felt in a way that, like, sound is always kind of secondary, I feel like, when we talk about style, especially with someone like Kubrick, but the way sound is used in that sequence in particular was incredible to me.
And I appreciated how the film prepares you for the challenge of that by bringing you along on this reconnaissance mission, mm-hmm. where you get a sense of the distance and of all of these barricades, all this wire they have to go through. It just seems at that point, before there's even any gunfire, that what they're attempting is to do is just impossible. Like, it's called an ant hell. It seems like it might be kind of close. It might as well be a world away and be a mountain, because it's just an impossible thing for them to have to do.
I think it's also just kind of genius that we don't really get any kind of like top-down perspective on the battlefield. We don't get a big wide view where we can see the progress that we're making. We're up there close in their space in the trenches, watching them crawl these just like agonizing like lengths and dying in droves. But you have this feeling, this has been going on so long, they must be close. And then you get the over the shoulder shot and see how far they still have to go. And it feels so hopeless. But stylistically, one of the things I think is most interesting about this movie is just the way he sets it up, that contrast between the raw moments of in the battle and then just like the clinical coldness of things like the courtroom scene. He keeps pulling back to that long shot of the room and the men like walking up to make their presentations to the judges and then walking back to their chairs. And what strikes me over and over in that shot is the three men with guns positioned mm-hmm. behind the three chairs. That room shot is so huge and so static that you just get this sense of every element in it. And seeing the fact that each one of them has their own armed guard standing there in case they, what, try to make a run for it? It's just so much part of the oppression and kind of the idiocy of the military thinking in this particular story.
Yeah. Also how this becomes a kind of secondary strategy, that if they fail in this mission, that the next mission is not really about justice. It's just about like, what the next thing is, to motivate the troops by killing these men for cowardice. That's the thinking, and it's, I guess, partially a face-saving measure, but
he uses the word we want to inspire them. Mm-hmm. Like nothing.
Seriously, I'm like looking at the notes I took watching this movie, and during that courtroom scene, like about halfway through, I just wrote "Arrgh!" I had that reaction you just had, Tasha, like "Arrgh!"
Yeah, it wasn't I just checked my notes, it wasn't inspiring, it was stimulating. The executions will be stimulating for the men,
in much the same way as shelling your own men might be stimulating.
Yeah,
and it's just, I mean, it's fascinating, because again, Moreau gets into the trenches and sees the men, but Brulard doesn't, and it's like such a poisonous irony that because he's a warmer character and because you've seen him at various points seem to be a voice of reason, you assume that he's a reasonable man. And then he gives that little speech at the end. Oh, we think we're doing a good job running the war. And, you know, execution is stimulating for men. We're talking about men who are watching all of their friends die around them. Mm. It's like one more death is somehow going to stimulate them or make them think differently.
Oh, come, Dax, let's not go over all that ground again. Though I must admit that, judging from the casualties, the efforts of your regiment must have been considerable.
How can you understand that and allow these men to be shot tomorrow?
Oh, come, Colonel, you're choosing to take a rather simple view of this thing.
The attack was impossible from the start. The general staff must have known that.
Colonel Dax, we think we're doing a good job running the war. You must be aware of the fact that the general staff is subject to all kinds of unfair pressures from newspapers and politicians. Maybe the attack against the anthill was impossible. Perhaps it was an error of judgment on our part. On the other hand, if your men had been a little more daring, they might have taken it. Who knows? In any case, why should we have to bear any more criticism of the failure than we have to? Aside from the inescapable fact that a good many of your men never left the trenches, there's the question of the troops' morale. Don't forget that.
The troops' morale?
Certainly. These executions will be a perfect tonic for the entire division. There are few things more fundamentally encouraging and stimulating than seeing someone else die.
I never thought of that, sir.
Well, you see, Colonel, troops are like children. Just as a child wants his father to be firm, troops crave discipline.
I see.
And one way to maintain discipline is to shoot a man now and then.
I wanted to kind of get into the controversy surrounding the film because it was significant. One of the things I really admire about it is that I think you would say you would want the French to prevail against the Germans in the war, broadly speaking. So for him to kind of make the French, in this specific example, the Sinister, is a pretty bold thing to do, or just it's a bold tack that's not necessarily specific to them at all in a lot of respects. But I'm rambling. But what do you think about the controversy? What do you think? Do you see the film as anti-military?
Oh, hell yeah.
It's anti-military, but it's not anti-soldier. Mm-hmm. Which I think is an interesting distinction to make.
I almost feel like you have to pull back a little further. I think it's anti-war in the very purest sense. I think it's sort of, let's just look at this from a distance and see how cruel and absurd and dehumanizing it is. And I think it's significant that we're on the side of the good guys in World War I here, because I think the underlying thing is this is how war works, and it's awful, and you need to look at it. And I think to imply anti-military is just a critique of a particular way of waging war instead of just the idea and act of war itself.
I think that's exactly right, and I'm trying to think about the time period, because it did, you know, was significantly it was decades after the war, but it drew a very strong response from veterans who had served in the war and from various countries throughout Europe, from France and also from Germany and Spain and other places. Were you surprised to learn that the response was as strong as it was?
I'm a little surprised to learn that Germany and Spain had those responses. I could see France having that response because it seems to be directly indicting the French military. But the fact that so many countries saw this movie as subversive and dangerous in some way and to be kept from the general public suggests that they saw some of themselves in it. It suggests that they think that there's a universality to it, that military leadership maybe can't be trusted, and that men who send other men off to die in their places perhaps cannot be trusted, and that the heroes are the people who push back against that. I can see that being considered a subversive, dangerous message in any country.
That's a good point, actually.
You know, this was several decades removed from World War I, but I think it's worth remembering that Kubrick was a teenager during World War II, which is, obviously, they are different wars, but they have a lot of similarities, including just like the pure body count. So I think that it's reasonable to assume that there is that this was made with a fairly strong anti-war intent from his perspective.
For sure. And it is something that I appreciate the degree to which the film captures what it was like to fight in World War I and trench warfare and then just that yard by yard. It's a horrible war to fight.
Yeah.
But he is advancing ideas that would apply to any war. And maybe as Tasha was suggesting earlier, what makes it a truly dangerous, subversive film, mm-hmm. because it does undermine fundamentally our reverence for the military and the people who lead the military and our trust in the decisions that they make and our assumption that they are always looking out first and foremost for the ground troops, the people who are really in harm's way, when in fact there are larger strategies at play, some of them noble, some of them petty and personal, that can result in death further down the food chain.
Truffaut has been widely quoted as saying that it's impossible to make an anti-war film because war is inherently exciting on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like this film proves that he was wrong about that, or that whoever originally said it.
I think he's been wrong about it so many times. Am I right?
No, I think it's a good quote to push back against mm-hmm. and think about, but I think it certainly applies to a lot of films, but I don't know that it applies to all films.
It's also one of those quotes that's really hard to source specifically.
Sure.
It gets passed around a lot, but regardless.
I thought it was Oscar Wilde who first said that.
or was it Vic Tabak?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I think that a couple of the ways that this proves that wrong, one is by showing exactly how painful and awful and terrifying and crushing like what you're talking about with the soundscape, particularly war is. But also what fascinates me about this film is that it's a war film that puts the battle in the middle and then never goes back to it. It's not a film about being at war. It's a film about the causes of war and how wars are perpetuated. And by distancing itself from that combat, it fascinates me so much that the first half of the film is about the importance or non-importance of this goal and about the battle that is fought to get there. And then not a further word is said about the strategic importance of the anthill or about any further effort to make it to the anthill, which makes it just so clear that it really was just about one person's ambition as much as he claimed it wasn't. Mm. It really was just about that promotion that he wanted, because nobody cares anymore once it's clear that they fail. They don't even talk about the end of the war and where it's going. It just becomes about murdering these men or not murdering these men. And I think that's such a fascinating narrative choice.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think, like, there's not a single victory, like, personal or military, in this movie. Like, no one comes out on top at all. And like, I think that is at odds with kind of what the Truffaut quote is getting at. Like, there is no excitement when there is no victory of any sort, you know, and that, I mean that in a very broad sense when I say that there's no personal victory. Like, I think that is important, that Moreau and Brulard also kind of come off the worse for both of these. Like, it's not even that the highest up officers get what they wanted. Like, they don't. And I think, like, the zero sum aspect of this movie's view of war is really pointed.
I feel like the closest we get to any kind of victory is Corporal Paris getting a hold of himself and going to his death bravely. You know, because we see him curled up and crumpled and weeping, but he's managed to pull himself together by the end.
Getting to look Roger in the eye.
And being the bigger man about that, because you're kind of anticipating a moment where he spits in his eye, or where he says, "It's coming for you too," or like whatever.
He doesn't accept his apology, though. I mean, he never says it's okay or anything to that effect.
He kind of nods a little bit. I mean, he gives him more than I would give him. That's for damn sure.
Well, that's a qualified victory if I ever heard one.
Very.
Yeah, well, you, I mean, they're all qualified victories. But, man, those performances, both Wayne Morris and Ralph Meeker in those roles, boy, they really come across. And this is a movie of some pretty tremendous performances.
Yeah, you don't have to make real characters out of those guys, but the movie does, and does it in a really efficient way. Everyone is so crisply drawn and efficiently drawn. The movie just gets so much done in 90 minutes. Yeah, good job, Stanley Kubrick. but I do want to get into what has been a point of contention for a long time among cinephiles, which is the end of the film with the German girl. What did you think of the ending? You know, some find it affecting, others sentimental. Where do you stand?
I found it confusing. Like, why does this random French bar have a captured German girl?
Why not?
Where'd they get her from? They go down to the German girl shoppery? Like, it raised so many questions for me that this was not the time to be asking those questions.
It didn't to me. I just assumed that she was a cat.
I just chalk up to, like, this kind of thing happens in war. It's like, you know, the Nazis had women as prostitutes. Like, mm-hmm. You know, like, women especially just are passed around in war, you know, be used to sum up movies, I guess.
Yeah. The first and only woman we see, right? Oh,
they're women
at
the
ball.
They're women
at the
ball,
of course. Okay. I love this ending. I find it very deeply moving, and I you know, if that makes me sentimental, then so be it. But I mean, it gets me every time I watch this movie. I think it speaks to some sort of underlying idealism that is not about our ability to connect with one another, that is almost drowned out by the circumstances in which we see it, and probably will not last any longer than that song lasts, but it's there. And if it's over, it still happened. I mean, I think it's fantastic. When Kubrick died, I read about Spielberg having a small gathering, and this is the scene he chose to show to some of his entire career. And you know, I don't think Kubrick was necessarily someone who formed, we don't hear a lot about, like, deep, warm friendships that Kubrick formed, but I know he and Spielberg had a relationship, and so I think it speaks to who Kubrick was, that this is the scene that his friend chose.
I agree that it's kind of a little confusing on the surface because of kind of the reasons you cite, Tasha, but I do think it's ultimately really important to the point the film is making, because it's about recognizing humanity in another person, and so much of this movie is about how war is kind of boiled down to sides, and you're just part of a larger whole. It's us and them. And like when the woman first comes on stage, she's drowned out. She's jeered and booed because she's them. She's the other. But as she sings and they like recognize her as a person and as an individual, mm-hmm. and they're like just struck by that. And I think that that is so integral to what this movie is trying to say about the human cost of war.
It's an interesting gesture for Kubrick to see this potential for humanity where I don't know that he would have later on. I think about this scene in contrast with the end of Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when they've finally killed the sniper who's a woman, and she's taken out God knows how many troops from her position, and you have these men who are hovering over her, and she's sort of bleeding out and desperate, and their reaction is not necessarily one of humanity. It's one of just of having all of that just stripped away. You know,
it's kind of a terrible echo of this. Yeah.
Well, isn't the last shot of Full Metal Jacket is the men marching together, whistling the Mickey Mouse song. So it's once again kind of a coming together around music and culture and this moment. Well, I mean, one of the things that I guess bothers me a little about the Paths of Glory ending is I don't see them responding to humanity. I don't see them responding to her specifically and recognizing her as a person. I see them responding to a piece of art, and seemingly a piece of art they all know because they all start humming along.
Oh, now when I say it's confusing, that is what's confusing to me, because she's singing a German folk song. So I'm like, why are they humming along? You know, I think that's a reasonable question. I also can just like chalk it up to like it's the nature of folk music to be kind of repetitive and easily learned.
And to cross borders.
Yeah.
I mean, think about Schnitzelbach. Like, how many people at this table could sing that song, even though it's in German?
I don't know. Maybe you should sing it.
Oh, der schöne, oh, der schöne, oh, der schöne Schnitzelbach.
I do feel like, though, there's a shared humanity that's being expressed at that moment. It's a soft ending.
It is a soft ending. It's just, for me, so much of this film feels completely universal and completely timeless. You know, as long as there's war, as long as old men send young men off to die in war, this film is going to be timely and have a place. But this communal singing of a folk song that I've never heard and have no connection to just seems specific to the time and place in a way that takes me out of the universality of it. I'm not saying it's a bad ending. It's very emotional. I think that Suzanne Christian gives it a tremendous performance. The tears streaking down her face are very convincing. And of course, I feel for her. And of course, it's touching to see the men not only responding to her, but crying as well. Mm-hmm. They're moved by a piece of art, and that is a beautiful moment. I don't hate this ending. I just don't think it's on the pitch-perfect level of so much of this film.
Does it make any difference to know that the folk song is about a soldier who is separated from his beloved one and is only allowed to return to her when she is already mortally ill?
That does make a difference. But it makes me wonder, like, do all these French people know that? Is there a French version of it? It's a very specific touch that, again, for me, it raises questions.
Is there a continent? That continent is Europe.
Actually, just before we wrap this up, one like very basic question I have is, why the French military? Is it just because that's what the book was?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the thing that I admired. I assume that was what the book was. I mean, like I said, the book was based on a New York Times article about French soldiers who were court-martialed in World War I, five of them. So I guess it's just taking from that specific case. But I just feel like that's the extra challenge of the film. And I think that gives it that extra level where, you're broadly speaking, you would want the French to defeat the Germans and feel like the overall cause is a righteous one, but that even the good guys are participating in this act of war in the war machine and making a lot of bad decisions.
It also, I mean, apart from the names, there really isn't much in here to designate this as the French military.
Yeah, it honestly took me a while to kind of click that it was the French military.
Yeah, nobody has accents. We don't use a lot of place names. Like, there's not anything specific, which makes it more universal. But it wouldn't surprise me to learn that Stanley Kubrick just would not have been able to get this funded if he was making it about the American military in this time period.
Yeah. I mean, he had a hard enough time, I think, with the way things were. And I'm fine with no one trying. I don't want to see Kirk Douglas try a French accent. I think it would have been a different film. It would have been a lesser film. But I really love the film that we have.
I do too.
Me too.
And with that, we'll take a break and be right back. Okay, so normally this is where we'd have feedback at this segment of the show, but for some reason people didn't appear to go out to see Baywatch and didn't have anything to say about the Brady Bunch movie either. So first off, we want to encourage our listeners to give feedback if they would like, and we'll give you that information. I'll give it to you right now. You can leave us a short voicemail, 773-234-9730. Or
it can
email
be a long
us.
Voicemail. I'll edit it down.
Okay, then you can do that too. And then you can also email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. So those options are there for you, and I'm sure you'll have plenty to say about Paths of Glory and then in the hit film Wonder Woman.
And if you're intimidated in any way about how hard it's going to be to get on the show, anyone could have gotten on.
Really?
We would have run a really bad letter.
We would have taken some. We wouldn't have taken some letter about how some culture club song figures into the Brady Bunch movie.
And your silence, it hurts our feelings.
It does.
We feel so alone.
It does. But
I think it's just because I wasn't here last week.
We feel like
I'm
Jan
the one
Brady.
Who inspires letters, right?
Angry letters. Keith gets all of our angry letters. So we are going to heed a piece of feedback that we got in the past about other pairings that we considered for the show. We are, after all, your cinematic sommeliers. and we did have a discussion about what would be right for Wonder Woman, because Paths of Glory is not necessarily the first thing that springs to mind when you're talking about a superhero movie. So
we had a really hard time picking a pairing, because there's such a long and vibrant tradition of superheroine-led movies with, you know, strong female leads. Mm-hmm. You're looking at me like I'm saying something that makes sense, Scott. Like you're actually
wait,
nodding.
Wait, no, I'm thinking. What's that one with Helen Slater?
Supergirl?
Supergirl? Yeah.
There's Supergirl. There's Elektra.
Everybody always forgets Elektra.
Everybody shouldn't forget Elektra. Elektra's a kind of terrible, pretty movie. But yeah, so not a lot of superhero in movies, which was one of the reasons that Wonder Woman is, you know, getting so much attention.
Norma Rae.
Aaron Brockovich.
Aaron Brockovich.
Well, Catwoman actually is another one that people
right.
cite.
Oh my gosh.
You know, there are a handful of superhero and quote unquote led movies.
Boy.
They tend to not be very
the
good.
The field was wide open for Wonder Woman, was it not? So, what did we consider, gang? The obvious choice was Superman, 1978.
It's a film I love, and it's one that Patty Jenkins said was a model for this Wonder Woman.
Right.
But I feel like we've done that show before. We did Batman and Batman, and we did, you know, we did old version of something. You know, we did
Iron Man and Civil War.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Star Wars and Star Wars. And, like, you know, and those, trust me, those were great shows.
Yeah.
Really, you should go.
You should revisit them and write us.
And we very well might do a show like that in the future.
Yeah,
but it will be great.
Yeah,
of course, it'll be so good. But, you know, maybe a break for that would not be a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I will just say, just as a kind of a trivia point, too, it wasn't even a reservation I had about this pairing, just like something I noted, is that the last DCEU movie we did, which is Suicide Squad, we also paired with a war movie, which was Dirty Dozen, which I just thought was like interesting. Like, what is it about the DC cinematic universe that calls to mind war movies?
Hmm.
But to go back to the Superman.
Stroke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to go back to the Superman 78 potential, like, I mean, like, that is a movie I would have loved to revisit, and I have seen, in addition to Patty Jenkins saying, you know, citing it as a model, like, I think there are definite comparisons to draw between Gal Gadot's performance in Wonder Woman and Christopher Reeves in Superman, just in terms of kind of the earnestness and the, well, you know, that's not a pairing we did, so we won't get into it.
But that was something, it almost was so strong a pairing that it was superfluous to even include it, because I know in the second half of the show, Superman will come into play in terms of how
says the man who wrote the second part of the show.
Yeah, so because I think they do have there's something about the way Wonder Woman is presented, and of course the roots of the character and her relationship to humankind in the fish out of water elements, they're all there, and so there's definitely a model to follow. So that was the obvious choice. The left field choice that I came up with was Splash. Keith is looking at me like, what were you smoking?
No, I'm thinking, yes, this actually makes sense.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
I'm willing to look at you like, what were you smoking?
Oh, no, I get it entirely.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been fun, because it would have allowed us to engage very fully with, like, some of my favorite aspects of Wonder Woman, which are the fish out of water, like, semi-comedic elements. And, I mean, I love Splash and would love to do that. However, we do have a gender-swapped Splash on the horizon, so we'll want to save that.
What's the gender?
Channing Tatum. Channing Tatum is the mermaid.
Oh,
It's going to be great, and we're going to do that pairing. Don't even say anything.
Is Scorsese directing that one? He's directing that one.
No, and it's Gillian Bell is the other one from 21 Jump Street.
Oh, so, her.
Yeah, it's going to be good. I'm excited about
it. She's the one who's going to say, Mr. Mango on my shoulder.
Probably.
Remember that?
Yes.
Do we have any reason to believe that the movie, like, I remember when it was announced and...
who knows if it'll actually happen.
You know, I made a joke about the merman in Cabin in the Woods and whether he was going to look anything like that. But yeah, I'm very curious to see whether it actually is going forward or is just one of those vaporware products.
Is it actually called Merman?
I think it's called Splash.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it's called Man Splash. Because, you know, if it's for a man, we get a tech man onto it, like Man Bun.
Yeah, it looks like August 1st, 2016 is when the world got excited about Channing Tatum as the merman. But,
well, that means it should be coming out any minute now.
We do that. Yeah. It's going to be Splash and Splash.
You'll be very glad we didn't do that.
But there is the fish out of water aspect is good. And also... a person contending with the flawed, semi-redeemable animals we call mankind.
And then there's that scene where Daryl Hannah, like, punches her way across a battlefield.
I remember that scene.
I didn't pipe up too loudly because I think I'm the only person who likes this movie, but I think Warhorse might have worked as well.
Oh, I like it's a
you know, it's a Spielberg, you know, the Spielberg-Kubrick connection we talked to you about before. It's a World War I film. Although it owes a lot more to John Ford than any other director. But I love that movie.
Warhorse.
And it's another...
underrated.
Yeah, exactly. It's another anti-war film, on the most basic level.
A lot of horses in Wonder Woman, too.
Yeah. All right, guys, erase this whole episode. Let's go watch Warhorse.
To this day, every time somebody says Warhorse, I just go to a Simpsons place and I hear Warhorse, the crime-solving horse, every single time. I couldn't take it seriously. I just think we would get ourselves into some conceptual trouble comparing a landmark story about a long-running woman character getting her first film with a story about a horse. I understand the comparison and I see the specific parallels in the specific war story and especially with the trenches, the barbed wire and the whatnot. I just think
we could finesse it though.
Superman is, I think, a smarter pair, like a safer pairing in some ways, because at least we're comparing a woman to a man and not to a horse.
Good point.
Crime solving horse.
Well, alternate history.
Yep, things that could have happened. So as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and the recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode.
We definitely will.
Yeah, we really will. Or really, just no matter how inane, or post it on Facebook for discussion. That wraps up this episode of The Next Picture Show. In part two, we'll look at World War I from the slightly more fantastical angle of Wonder Woman, which uses the closing days of the Great War to test the compassion and will of its Amazon warrior and whether humanity itself is worth saving. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter @nextpicturepod so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be arguing whether it's best to die by bayonet or machine gun.
Bayonet is right out.
Anything but
die
gas.
Die Botschaft bracht, dass sein Herzliebchen im Sterben lag. Da ließ all sein Hab und Gut und eilte seinem Herzliebchen zu. Da ließ all sein Hab und Gut und eilte seinem Herzliebchen zu.